party.
Was it at his manager's place or something?
No, it wasn't at, it was not at his manager.
Albert Grossman, I think.
Albert Grossman.
Yeah.
A very, very gross individual.
He became his name.
Anyway, and Sally's still alive, his wife. And she owns that huge complex that Albert put together.
Right, she's on the cover of Bringing It All the Way, Bringing It All Back Home. I think she's the one in the little dining room mantelpiece scene on the cover of the album.
The complex is called The Bear.
Anyway, right.
So we're at a party, and there's a big plate glass window, huge picture window, and there's a whole bunch of people standing inside there, including Judy. And I'm outside and with Bob and a couple of other people, and some guy comes, parks and comes in, and he's got this gun.
A rifle or a pistol?
No, a shotgun. And Bob says, "What's that? Let me see that." And he hands it to him, and Bob picks it up and points it at the window, and I knock it down. And everybody's saying, "Garrett, what are you doing?" And I said, "Hey, he's pointing it at my old lady. The gun's not loaded." I said, "Who said it wasn't loaded? How am I supposed to know whether it's loaded or not? You think Bob knows whether it's loaded or not?"
Hey, what did Dylan do? Look sheepish?
He was angry.
He was angry that you interrupted him.
Yeah.
They were all
angry because they're all, Dylan ass lickers.
Now, did you have? Is this the period when he had his house up there? Dylan had his house, and you could go swim there.
Absolutely. I mean, I knew Bob. It wasn't like I was doing it to some stranger or anything.
Did you like his music?
Yes, I liked his music, and we got along okay most of the time, and I still like his music. He's a good writer,
Yeah. Now, what would you say?
But he could be very unpleasant.
And why do you think that was? If you had any inkling that people all say that he was a bit quote moody.
Oh, I mean, one time we were doing a multimedia show at the Woodstock Artists Association. I was handling slide projectors and tape recorders, Michael, and Bob came, stood behind us. I mean, not in the audience, but, we were at the back of the room, and starts asking me questions, and I say to him, "Hey, Bob, not during the performance, please, I mean, he's a performer. He knows better than to do that." But that's how he was,
kind of selfish or self-absorbed.
And of course, his whole trip about changing his name didn't make him my favorite person.
Why? Why'd you have a problem with that?
Hey, when you're Robert Zimmerman, right?
Yeah.
And you become Bob Dylan, there's something in terms of rejecting your origins, isn't there?
Right. Do you think he was worried about having a Jewish name?
Of course he was. Of course he was worried about having a Jewish name. He wanted to be a Goyish folk singer,
So
still
resent him for that.
Yeah, and his style was like that. And that doesn't have anything to do with the fact that he's a good poet,
Yeah.
A lot of good poets are strange people. Dylan was the other Dylan,
Dylan
was well, yes, was also a strange guy and very depressive. And Bob could be very depressive.
That's what people report. Is there any other stories of that period? That, I mean, did you meet Joan Baez, Richard Farina, the scene around Dylan?
There were people dropping in and out. Robbie Robbins. The whole band. They were nice.
Yeah, they were the Hawks people. What's his name? Robbie. No, not Robert. The leader. He's a Toronto. Well, he's from Arkansas, but he was playing in Toronto in the mid-60s, and the Hawks.
Mm-hmm.
I'll look it up in a minute. But the thing is, so you're going back and forth with from Woodstock to the church. Are you doing LSD much?
Yeah, quite a bit.
What did you? Dylan said in '69 that he did LSD for a while, and he said it was. Kept repeating itself, and it was like going through a revolving door or something like that, and he said it was useless. Did you come to that feeling?
No, never. I mean, I came to the feeling that I had done enough at a certain point, but not that it was boring.
Well,
I think revolving doors are pretty boring. I was never bored. Sometimes,
did you feel that you got more and more insights every time?
No, I got more insights at the beginning.
And then they died off, and it just was sensory stimulation?
No, it was an experience. But, the last thing I had, after that I stopped, it was kind of a death trip, which are common.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't enjoy it. How could you?
And is this in 64? Can you say...
Probably a little later. It was up at the Cape.
Cape Cod.
Yeah. Paul Williams' house. Yeah. I have a recording of it.
Of your death trip.
Yes. Well, there were a lot of people there.
How are you getting your LSD?
How are you getting it?
Yeah. Who's providing it for you?
What are you, the FBI and I?
No, okay, I have some other reasons to bring it. I'm just wondering, Sandoz? Do you feel you're getting Sandoz?
No, I don't think I ever had Sandoz, and I'm not happy about that.
Well, you got to listen to our interview with Dave Worster, who had 300 trips on Sandoz with Captain Al Hubbard, A.M. Hubbard, in the late 50s. That's another thing.
Well, Sandoz wasn't available.
Right.
There was all kinds of stuff available. There were some really good chemists out in the West Coast. I scored in a nudist colony once near the what do you call those cactuses?
What state?
California.
You mean
Joshua, near the Joshua Tree Reserve, right?
Right. And so. Okay, I'm just checked it. It's Ronnie Hawkins was the singer that the Hawks played for. And
I didn't know him.
Yeah, and he's a famous Canadian tradition legend now, but they were playing with him up in Toronto while being in Woodstock. This is 64, 65, 66.
Yeah, I kind of remember there was a scene up in Toronto, yeah.
Yeah, so there's, looking at the notes here, I've got Dennis Hopper at the L.A. show, Barry McGuire, Eve of Destruction.
Barry was a good friend of mine.
How did you meet him? That was in L.A.?
In Topanga Canyon. He was living with Patty Elan, who was a good friend of ours, and the Mamas and the Papas used to hang out there. And we did acid together. We did DMT together. He had a swimming pool. He was very popular at the time because he had done Eve of Destruction
song,
which was his big song, And then later on, I knew him when he was in here in New York.
Okay.
Now, then he became a Christian, born again, but I think he's cooled it out now. I talked to Patty on the email about a month ago, and she's in touch with him, but I'm not. I could be.
Okay, just looking at the notes, we forgot.
We just used that line in our opera, our Psyche and Delia psychedelic opera. You know,
with Ed Rosenfeld.
Yeah, the Dunn and McGuire couldn't get higher. You know, it's a Mama Papa song, right?
Yeah, is that Monday Morning? No, what song is
I
that?
Don't remember.
That's the
I
one.
It's
about how they became famous. They run through the whole.
Yeah.
They were down in the Caribbean or something. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
But look at the notes. We didn't go into this. We ended with "Who Are You and What's Happening" in the last show, and then my next note is "Acid Trip" with Roger Watts.
No, not Roger.
And Alan
Summers.
Watts.
Roger Summers, S-O-M-E-R-S.
And I've got, so Alan Watts was part of that?
Alan Watts was living on Roger's property on Mount Tamalpais in Mill Valley.
Right, and I have the name Elsa.
Elsa Gidlow, G-I-D-L-O-W.
So you did this acid trip with Roger, that was your first trip? Why do
yep. Yep, with Roger and a lot of other people in Roger's house.
And Watts might have been there.
No, he wasn't at that trip. He
right.
was on the property. But that was when we were building Contact is the Only Love.
Yes. And what do you remember about that first acid trip?
It was a wonderful trip. Just a fantastic trip. And kind of an orgiastic trip.
You mean with other people?
Yes. And
super hedonistic.
Super hedonistic, right. Yeah. And it transformed me. Before that, I think I told you this before, that I used to get hysteric. And after that trip, I've never had a hysteric episode again. And I had them all the time since I was a young child.
When you didn't speak for, well, some article says a year, was that a hysterical episode?
No.
No, that was a... based on something else.
Yes, that was before.
Yeah, that was before.
Yes.
But if you had done acid before that, would you have done that? I'm just wondering if that was...
I don't know. I mean, maybe I would have found an easier way to get out of the contretemps.
Yes. So so that's in San Francisco, you do acid, and that's before Who Are You and What's Happening.
In Mill Valley, yes.
Do you do acid much more in that
yes.
period?
Yes.
Is that when
yes.
Owsley is making acid, or is that before him?
No, after.
That's after.
I mean,
okay.
No, before.
Before.
You're right, before, yeah. I don't know whose acid it was, but there was plenty of acid around.
Yeah.
Eventually, at that time, there were two guys whose names I won't mention in L.A. who made it, and that's when I told you that we scored at a nudist camp.
Yeah.
And then we had this weird trip trying out. It was liquid acid. It wasn't blotter acid or pill acid. And we had this weird trip out in the Joshua Tree desert in the middle of the night when we were all high. There weren't that many, but Judy and I. Who else? But we heard these enormous voices. I mean, sounds. And then there were lights and shining in the sky, and we thought it was an alien ship. You know, because
mm-hmm.
that was the right there is when where they had a lot of sightings, right?
Probably George Adamski was the guy in the 50s around there.
Right, and. What happened eventually is we had this little camp in the middle of the Joshua Tree Desert, and on either side of us, about 10 heavy-duty Harley motorcycles with riders came passing by us on both sides of us, which is what the lights had been, you know. And they didn't stop. They just kept on going. Of course, you know, by the time that we saw them, we realized it wasn't some extra terrestrial phenomenon, but boy, it was a heavy-duty scene during a trip.
Were they Hell's Angels?
Yeah. I don't know if they were real angels or some motorcycle club, but they were a club, yeah.
And they passed by you on either side.
Right.
Yeah.
And they didn't give a shit about us.
In my notes here, I have after it's the ass trip and then the Vancouver guy, Alvin Balkine, and then it says McLuhan and Fordham Money. Did you do some gigs with Fordham Money in that 64?
No.
I don't know why that. Then I have Eugene Oregon film scandal, Verbal American Landscape. So that does happen around that period.
I don't know. It had nothing to do with the Verbal American Landscape, Eugene.
Yeah, that was the was that the Pacific Northwest thing or something else?
Eugene was why the film of the nude and with the highway sign.
Yeah, that's not Verbal American Landscape.
No, it is not.
That's called Why.
Yeah, and it's a black and white film.
Right, and
it was made with Ivan Mazdrakov, my friend, and Michael Callahan, and it was funded by the attorney George Walker, who had to use his legal talents to get it out of the lab.
And is that the one with the woman's body?
Yes.
And whose body was that? Can you say?
Judy, my wife at the time.
At the time, who
did that?
Who was also on the Alice Street trip with the motorcycles coming by?
Right.
Okay, the...
She was on all those trips. She was in Vancouver. She was at Who Are You and What's Happening. She was...
Were you married at that point? Did you marry pretty quickly?
No, we were never married.
Oh, okay. So, I have here the next thing. It's interesting. I have Ananda Kumaraswamy. Okay? I made note of that because McLuhan...
Usko. That was the inspiration for Usko, but Ananda Kumaraswamy goes back to KPFA and Grace Clements.
And what did Grace do?
She introduced me to Ananda Kumaraswamy's works.
And what was it about them that was an inspiration?
Because he talked about the artist in traditional societies not signing things and being a craftsman like anybody else.
Right. I made note of it personally because McLuhan quotes him one or two times in his essays on art in that period.
Mm-hmm. He was the Asian curator at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, but he was dead by then.
Right. So the Paul Lee strobe lights. My note there, Paul Lee.
What about that?
Is he the guy who invented strobe lights? Yeah, he's the guy.
No. That was Harold Edgerton. Paul Lee was originally. Paul Lee is one of the students of theology who was part of the Leary group. You know, the theology students that took
LSD
psychedelics.
At Harvard.
Yes, I don't believe it was LSD. I believe it was the other stuff, you know. Oh, God. Anyway.
What other stuff would there be? I mean, DMT or MD?
No. What was it before LSD?
Oh, psilocybin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Paul was that. Paul was a... He sponsored us when he was the Protestant chaplain at Brandeis University, which, of course, was after the Timothy stuff. He then was Paul Tillich's assistant at MIT.
Yeah.
And he is still a friend of mine. He's the guy who got me the job at the University of California at Santa Cruz in the 70s.
Yeah.
And he's still in Santa Cruz.
So what?
He comes from a Wisconsin family originally.
So how did you meet
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Right, how did you meet him?
We met him... How did we meet him?
Through Leary?
No, I think through Gunther Weil, who was one of Leary's people.
Yeah, I saw Gunther Wilde speak in 1968 in Montreal. He was hipped on Gurdjieff at that point.
Yeah, well, he's been hipped on somebody or other ever since before that and after that. His father was a famous psychologist also, European. They were refugees. I mean, Gunther was born here.
Right. Do you
we were very close for a lot of years, but he then kind of screwed around with us during intermediate systems.
Right, so you were close in the middle 60s with him.
Mm-hmm. We met under the waterfall at Millbrook.
That reminds me, do you believe that Andrew Weil, the famous alternative
yes.
medicine icon, was
yes.
the guy who turned in Leary at Harvard? That's, some people say that. That he
could have been. I you know, he was around.
Yeah.
I mean, he used acid.
He used acid, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, so I'm looking at this list, and there's a whole bunch of factors here. You got the Boston LSD scene, you got Millbrook, you've got Jonas Mekas, you got Carolee Schneeman and the Dancers, you're doing We Are All One, and...
Well, I mean...
Is that all 64 or into 65?
No, it's a sequence. Probably you're talking about things that happened in two or three years, or
yeah.
maybe four. Yeah.
Well,
I think the Schneeman thing was toward the end, because then we worked together with Carolee and for Intermediate 68. I think it was 68, yes. And so it keeps on happening.
Right, so this is leading up to you getting publicity on the cover or inside Life magazine with your Astro performance.
We had two covers. One was of the World, the discotheque we did on Long Island, and the other was the psychedelic issue, which featured our Riverside Museum show.
Right, the. In the Warhol documentary, they talk about the Dom, and he starts having the Velvet Underground and light shows there. Remember the Dom?
Yeah, what happened was when Michael Meyerberg had leased the hangar that Lindbergh had taken off on Roosevelt Field, people who leased it to him would not allow him to put a movie studio, which he wanted to put in there. So he decided to put a discotheque, and he hired John Brockman to find the artists who could do this media discotheque. And John brought us and Ken Dewey and Andy and...
Andy Warhol.
Robert. Well, yeah.
Andy Warhol.
And Robert, I can't think of his last name.
Did you say Ken Dewey?
Yes. Ken didn't want to do it. We won, and I went to Andy, and I said, Andy, how would you like to do this together? And he looked at me in that kind of supercilious way he had, and he said, together? And... we opened, and it was a big deal, you know. It was the first video projector, an Ida 4, that they loaned to us from Switzerland. We had like 30 slide projectors. You know, it was a wild scene. And Andy then opened his own place, the Electric Circus on the Dome.
And on St. Mark's Place, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think was 22 St. Mark's Place. I checked it out at one point.
It wasn't what it's cracked up to be. I mean, you know, as far as media were concerned, what we had was very sophisticated compared to what he had.
Yeah.
Ours was programmed again.
Yours was programmed, right. And he had just the band Velvet Underground with Nico and some lights and Gerard Malanga dancing around in front.
Whatever happened that night would be happening. Yeah, they had a lot of colored lights. But, you know, and the dimming and brightening, but, you know, and they showed films.
Right, on the wall. So are you, you're being recognized as being a way more sophisticated electric
conductor? No, I wouldn't say we were recognized. Andy had a much bigger reputation than we did.
At the time, yeah, at the time.
Andy was a big success. We were hippies.
Right, but you made the cover of Life. Maybe he made cover of Life for other reasons, but you were on the cover in 66, in that period.
Yeah, but, you know, and we were on a lot of other stuff, too, but we were on the at the Riverside show. We were on the Barbara Walters show. You know, okay. But in those days, media was a lot more receptive to our type of stuff. You know, now the media is a celebrity trip, right?
Yeah. You have to be famous in another medium to get into the mainstream media.
Yeah, I'm not famous that way now.
No.
And we didn't really like it that much even then, you know. We kind of dropped out because we didn't want to be that public.
That's right. And the just looking up the Lindbergh, since you were in the factory, in the hangar where he came out of, did that on May 21st, 22nd, 1927. So we're looking at 39 years later, 40th anniversary almost, when you guys are in the world. Does the world go into 67, or is that too specific date-wise? I mean, how long did you do that?
I don't know. It was, I think, over a year. I mean, Michael did it every weekend, and that's how we funded a lot of our work, including the Riverside Museum show.
In the Bancroft oral history, you guys get a bit disappointed, or in the crowd, the Long Island crowd, or the weekend, college kids and high school kids. Is that who's coming?
Yeah,
to the world?
I mean, they were bouncers, and you know, the music was great, but it was a big deal for a while, and then it kind of, you know, first of all, when it opened, it was Murray the K's World.
He was a famous DJ.
Yes. And he and Michael Meyerberg didn't get along, so he got fired, and then it became the World. And eventually, Meyerberg moved it to Miami, where Michael reset it up for him. But it wasn't such a success in Miami. It didn't last very long.
So in this, so we're covering 64 to 66, 67. What can you tell us about going to Millbrook, and why did you end up at Millbrook, visiting there?
Why did we visit at Millbrook?
And Millbrook was the estate that Peggy Hitchcock and her brothers provided for Tim Leary.
Yeah, Billy and Tommy. Why did we go there?
You knew probably some people in Boston. Maybe it was the Boston connection.
Well, no, I don't think so. I think we had met some of the people, maybe in Boston and around, and we were part of the scene. I don't remember the actual sequence, but we spent a lot of time up there, and one of the early times was when, but we'd been there before, Ralph Metzner, who was, you know, it was Tim and Richard and Ralph were the three people. Ralph called me one day and said, "Hey, we just took this really extraordinary rabbi on his first LSD trip. You've got to meet him next time he comes to New York." That was Zalman Schachter. It must have been in the mid-60s. And he said, you know, I am not, Ralph was a refugee also. He said, you know, I'm not into that Jewish stuff the way you are, but I know you are. You would really like. And not long thereafter, I did meet Zalman in New York and took him up to the church, and we've been good friends ever since. He's been a terrific influence on me.
Now, you had already been studying the Kabbalah and things like that, right?
Yeah, yes.
And was he an expert on that?
Yes.
So what kind of conversations or how is he an influence?
He is a spiritual alternative Jew and a fantastically wise and educated in Jewish literature and Jewish ritual and being an Orthodox rabbi and, you know, eating healthy foods and having important relationships with women and people of all faiths, including, you know, Hindus, Buddhists, Catholics, whatever you can think of. He's a remarkable human being, and he's originally an Austrian, a Viennese. He was in the camps for a short time, and he and I, you know, have a German heritage, so we had a lot in common.
How do you spell his last name?
S-C-H-A-C-H-T-E-R, Schachter.
S-C-H-A-C-T-E-R.
S-C-H-T-E-R. Zalman, Z-I-L-M-A-N.
Zalman, yeah. So he's older than you, right?
A little bit, yes.
So I'm just seeing in the wiki if he comes up. That's S-C-H-A-C-T-E-R.
S-C-H-A-C-H.
Doesn't Rabbi Schachter, former chairman of the Conference of Presidents of America, Major American Jews, at?
No.
Oh, Reb Zalman hyphen Schachter.
Right. Shalomi Schachter, yeah.
Just getting that, see if that comes up. Zalman hyphen Schachter. Nothing comes up, but I bet you if I Google him, he'll come up.
Yes, there's lots of stuff on the internet about him.
So he was did he take LSD? Why did this, in the context of Millbrook, did he come up?
What do you mean, why?
Did he take LSD? Did he take LSD?
Yes, that's why Ralph called me.
Okay, so he may be the reason you end up at Millbrook?
No. We had been at Millbrook before. And we did shows at Millbrook, and then we did the psychedelic theater in New York for them as a benefit.
Right, that's about 1965 or so.
Yeah. See, so we were there before that.
Okay,
probably 2 years before that. Probably very soon after I came back from San Francisco, we visited them.
Okay, because
we were in the LSD scene, and they were in the LSD scene.
That's right. You'd done it in California.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in the Wikipedia, it's Zalman Schachter hyphen Shalomi.
Yes, that's him.
Yeah, born 1924, and he hasn't died yet.
No, he hasn't. He's in Boulder, Colorado. He's got an endowed chair at the, you know, Trungpa
Rinpoche
College.
Institute? The Trungpa Rinpoche.
Yes.
Yeah, the poetry part was the Institute for Disembodied Poetics or something like that.
Yeah, Ann Waldman runs that.
And is this Zalman's scene, or is he another department?
He's in the Department of Judaic Studies.
So, what did you think of Billy Hitchcock and Peggy Hitchcock? They got in trouble, or Billy got in trouble later.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, they and their brother Tommy and their wives, the two of them, and Peggy wasn't married. She was into Timothy, really, but it never really worked. She later married Walter Bohart, who's, you know, the East Village Other.
Yeah, the founder of the East Village Other.
Yeah, and that didn't work. And Peggy's now into the Dalai Lama.
Yes.
She lives in Arizona.
But what did you think of Peggy back then as a person?
There were these three rich young adults, right? And they owned this huge estate, and they were, you know, in a sense, playing around with dynamite.
Yeah.
And
why do you think their personalities made them want to do that? Now, Peggy had done a lot of stuff. She was involved with a jazz musician before that.
Yes, yes.
A race car driver in Europe. I know Peggy well in her history. I've interviewed her.
Yes. I know, you've told me.
Right.
Well, but and Billy, Billy was a wild, you know, stockbroker with Lehman Brothers and other. And Tommy was kind of the most conservative of the three. Of course, their father had been a wild man, right?
Right. He died in 1944 on the Rolls-Royce jet. He invented a machine, a jet thing that was put in the planes and helped the American pilots. But he flew in one of them and it crashed in 1944.
So was that Tommy Hitchcock?
Yes, he was the polo player, you know.
Yeah, the polo player. He'd been married 9 times, right?
Yeah, I didn't know he was married 9 times, but he's Peggy's father.
Right, I know. Well, and Tommy and Billy's father, too.
Yeah. So,
I wrote Peggy lately, but she didn't answer it, because the three of them are in our opera.
Yeah, right, as characters.
They have a very short scene, but they're there.
Well, that's interesting. The opera is about, from what I understand, is about MK Ultra, Sidney Gottlieb, the CIA use of drugs and hypnosis. Is this Ed's vision, Ed Rosenfeld's vision of...
No. Ed wrote a film script called MK Ultra, but the CIA scene is only one of the 10 scenes in our opera. We have Carlos Castaneda, Anthony Nartou, Maria Sabina. We have, you know, the DNA discoverers. We have, we do have Sid Gottlieb, you know.
Yeah.
But we have him before and after, you know.
Right.
And we have Leary and the LSD conference and what, Cary Grant. Big opera.
Is it about?
It starts out with the Delphic Oracle.
Yeah, I mean in history, way back.
Yeah.
Is this about drugs?
Is the opera about drugs?
Yeah.
The opera is about the psychedelic experience. Yes, through history.
Yeah. Do you remember? When I met you in the summer of summer of 2000, we met at Mark Stallman's loft, and we'd been running the nonlinear circle there. And Ed, and psychologist
Neil.
Buddy Neil, came to these, and there were many. There was a lot of discussion on our email list and at these get-togethers, which were once a month from 98 to 2000, about the history of Ergo and LSD and all this stuff. And arguments between Mark Stallman and Ed, because Mark had written, had done the research on MK Ultra for Lyndon LaRouche in the book Dope Inc. It came out in the late 70s. And so Mark was not an enthusiast of LSD, and maybe Ed was, and this argument was a lot. Ed learned a lot from Mark. Mark learned a lot from Ed, and they shared a lot. I'm sure that the nonlinear circle and the content and thinking that went on for 2 years is a part of Ed's script or a lot of the information in there. Because
he did a lot of the research. Basically, you know, I'm responsible for the poetry and he's responsible for the research. We have JFK in it also, by the way.
Yeah, with Mary getting added.
Yes, Mary Mayer, yes.
Right. I checked that out through the Evergreens, the medium, what actually happened there. I don't have it right here with me, but I have to listen to that. Maybe it's something I can help you with that. I mean, according to the Evergreens are the spirits that come through Michael Blake Reed, a very tremendous medium, and they said, that Kennedy did take LSD.
Yes, he did. I mean, we have the research.
Yeah, and do you have some, you know, secular paper confirmation of that?
Ed does.
Okay. So it's the history of, do you bring in Terrence McKenna?
No, we don't get to Terrence.
Right. But it's Ed's interest in this and your interest in it. It's a key part of the 20th century, but you guys create a historical perspective on it.
Right.
Okay, so Mark Stallman would take the view that the Hitchcocks consciously on behalf of the oligarchy or the corruptors of society were spreading LSD.
What do you mean? I mean, Billy was financing it.
Right, and that this was planned by a certain element in the CIA to disrupt the minds of the baby boomers.
What they were doing what the CIA was doing and what Billy was doing were completely different things.
Right, you didn't see any CIA guys lurking around Millbrook.
No. Not in my time.
Right, and did you think that that Leary's view of spreading LSD among, quote, the people, versus Captain Hubbard's view from the 50s, you know Captain Tripps, A.M. Hubbard, you know about him?
Yeah.
The one who was in charge of distributing any Sandoz LSD on behalf of Sandoz in North America.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was the one who controlled it, and CIA apparently got it from him. He was the control point. According to Dave Worster, this person who was working with Hubbard in the late 50s taking LSD in Seattle. But Hubbard was trying to turn on the elites, the presidents, prime ministers, and that. He did not believe it should go among the citizens, whereas Leary was different. Leary was more, at least associated with the mass distribution.
Timothy was basically an alcoholic, you know, who turned to drugs and a deeply flawed individual for various reasons, including the suicide of his first wife and his history at Kaiser. And he was involved with the CIA from the time he was in college, and he knew Cord and Mary.
Yes, and he developed the personality test, was it?
Yes,
yeah.
Which is still used.
Yeah.
CIA and the FBI.
Did you have an opinion yourself, if there was a debate, about keeping it for the elites or spreading among whoever wanted it? Did you have a position in that?
Hey, I thought everybody should use it, just like, you know, yeah, sure. I mean, everybody who wanted to use it, I didn't think anybody should be subjected to it. But, you know, if it was done in a safe environment, and the setting, you know, was correct for the people who were taking it, it invariably had very positive results. The problem, as it is with practically any medicinal or non-medicinal drug, is the use of it, you know, in unsafe circumstances, for reasons of gain. Monetary or sexual or emotional, or, you know, it doesn't work that way. You need a really safe, secure environment with good inputs, preferably music that somebody likes, fire, natural landscapes, and the results are wonderful for most people, but you know, the other side of it is terror. So people jump out of windows, all that kind of thing happens. The binary phenomenon that we know in so many intellectual and emotional circumstances.
Right. So what did you think of how the Leary LSD movement, as it developed through the decade, did you have any opinions about it? Because obviously it got out of control.
Look, I was sympathetic. I was also very critical. I produced, later on, Timothy's album, you know. His self-promotional side and his turned me on. And, he was fantastic in certain ways. He could, from memory, do Finnegan's Wake 3 or 4 pages at a time, right?
Well, I didn't know that. I didn't know he could recite things late.
And he was very Irish, you know.
Yeah.
but on the other hand, he was very self-centered, righteous. He had a Catholic background, which has certain characteristics that aren't necessarily so wonderful. The thing that surfaced continuously was his alcoholism.
Yeah.
Which went way back.
Right. So the,
And he wasn't, he definitely was a betrayer.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're at Millbrook, was there a sense of community, a sense of the world discovering new things?
Yes, there were, some really wonderful people hanging out there. Jazz musicians, poets, artists, religious people. It drew a lot of fantastic people, but the dynamic was very edgy. I mean,
edgy in a good sense or dangerous?
No, edgy, and I mean, when Timothy married Nina. Right.
Yeah, Robert, the present Bob Thurman's wife.
Exactly. Una's mother.
Una Thurman, the actress's mother, right. That and they were, I don't know if Peggy was much of a friend of Nina's then, or is it Nina?
Yeah,
or?
I mean, they were friendly, but I mean, Peggy had been sideswiped.
That's right, sideswiped by Nina, is that how you say her name? Nina?
No, by Timothy. Forget about Nina.
Nina.
Yeah. Swedish fashion model.
Yes, and so she gets drawn into the Leary world, and she's...
I was at the wedding.
Okay, and that lasted a year or so, right?
Yeah, at least. Yeah. I don't remember. They went to India, and,
But was Peggy at the wedding?
Yes.
Yeah, so... Peggy was
at the wedding. Billy was at the wedding. I can't remember Tommy. Richard was at the wedding, and he injected the champagne with LSD. People had accidents, and people were vomiting all over the place. Thank God I didn't drink any.
Wow.
I mean, there were suckling pigs and whole hams, and I mean, it was turkeys, and, people were looking at the food and vomiting.
Wow.
And there was rock bands, and I was at the church beforehand. It was a nightmare.
So this was Richard Alpert, who became famous as Baba Ram Das. Maybe that's why he's obsessed in the New Age world. He can't get over the pranks that he used to saw him do in the mid-60s.
We have that scene in the opera. We also have the scene where he took us up in a plane, a few of us. He had his own plane. He was rich.
Yeah.
His father was the head of the railroad, and he took us up in the plane, and when we got up, just for kind of a joyride, he said, "Hey, guys, what do you think? I took 350 mics before we took off."
Gee.
And he was the pilot.
Wow, so was that scary, or you just suppressed
it? Yeah, that was fucking scary, yes.
It was all over. You weren't going to land.
Well, we landed, I don't know if he was telling us the truth.
Right.
That was Richard.
So he spiked...
Richard was not my friend. he was jealous of my relationship with Steve Durkee.
Right. But he spiked the champagne
You understand, he's also maybe bisexual, but basically gay.
Yeah. But he spiked the champagne without anybody...
You don't think that's important?
No. I guess it's important. I've heard it.
It's vital to the whole story.
Okay. Do you want to elaborate why it's
no,
vital?
No. I mean, you know, the sexual orientation and the jealousies that eventuate from it are vital to that kind of a story and to the development of those relationships.
Right, and it's in the period when it's tough to be gay. It's before the coming out of
it. He was in the closet.
Yeah. Now, you're saying he spiked the champagne and nobody knew he was doing this.
Nobody knew.
So this is his, you know.
You know there's that little hole in the metal cap?
Yeah.
In champagne bottles?
Yes.
He injected it with a syringe.
So this is a blow for gay against the bourgeois middle class heterosexual marriage. This is a gay attack on the.
No, I don't think so. Sure, you could label it as that, but I mean, it was a typical Richard Alpert prank.
The spoiled rich kid.
Rich boy's prank.
Yeah.
You know, and he was a prankster. And except he didn't get along with the pranksters. I mean, when Ken Kesey drove up in the bus with his group, you know, the two groups just didn't make it together.
And were you there for that?
No, I was there when the bus came to the World's Fair, though, which was the same trip.
Okay, there's 64. We got a date. That's 1964.
Yeah.
So this is in the middle that year. Then that's the middle. That's, yeah, that's after, okay. That's your year at Millbrook, so to speak. That's
we'd already been at Millbrook, yeah.
Yeah, and you'd come back in January, February '64 from San Francisco.
So we must have gone to Millbrook practically immediately.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what it probably was, the connection. It was the people, I know what it was. It was the two guys I told you about who I scored with at the nudist camp.
Yes. That's out in L.A.
Yeah,
L.A. area.
They were the connection to Millbrook.
So they told you about the scene there, and so you...
No, they wanted to get connected, and I said, oh, I know those people.
Okay, how did you know them?
I had met them in Boston.
Right, and that would be Tim Leary? You're talking about meeting Tim?
Yeah, Tim.
Paul Lee, yes.
Paul Lee.
And Alpert, I guess Alpert.
I don't think I'd met Alpert until Millbrook.
But you can't remember why you met them in Boston.
I think I went up with Philip LaMantia, actually.
Yeah, because Ginsberg and Aldous Huxley and Alan Watts, they were visiting Leary in 62, 63 when he was at Harvard. And you were part of that circle. You probably heard about it.
Yeah. I think I went up when Philip LaMantia came east. I'm not sure.
And that would be before you went up to San Francisco in 63.
Could be.
Okay. Now, you provided background for Richard Alpert's tours across the country.
No.
I mean, you saw him lecturing. I think you went across the country, or I think you told me you did something, provide light shows, I'm not sure, and that's where you'd see him lecture and then distribute LSD
We did the psychedelic theater, and eventually... Steve and Barbara moved out to live with Richard in his house on the peninsula with Jane Burton.
Jane Burton?
Yes.
Who's that? Name sounds... Is that Jane?
No, that's Jane Burton, who was part of the scene around Stanford and who had a child by... the novelist.
Henry Miller?
No. Much younger than that. The guy who studied with, who was the famous writer who taught at Stanford? He taught Kesey too.
Yeah.
It was that part of that whole trip.
Right, but you say the peninsula, you mean the Monterey Peninsula? Or Marin?
No, no, I mean around Menlo Park, Palo Alto.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So they, Steve and Barbara, went out to be with Richard out there.
Yep.
And they liked, he liked Richard. Steve liked Richard.
Yeah, they got along. They got along, but you know they weren't lovers, which I think Richard was aiming for. But the whole scene there was that they were lecturing around the country, LSD illusion or reality.
They mean Steve and Richard?
Yes. But Richard was selling LSD out of the stage door.
Okay, and so you weren't there. You heard about this from Steve.
Yes, and I went out to visit my kids who were out there. And I stayed with them, and that turned into a very bad scene.
We haven't talked about your kids in a long time in this series. What were they doing at that point? Who were they with?
Jane was still alive, and they were with Jane, Rada and Abram.
Right. And that was a bad scene with Jane or with you?
No, it was a bad scene. Nothing to do with them. All right. We're at Richard's house, and Jane, who I didn't know, says to me, "Let's go find Ken." I say, "I thought Ken was in Mexico, because he was supposedly fleeing from the police, right?" She says, "Oh, that's just a story. He's not in Mexico. He's around. We can find him." So
yeah, we're talking about Ken Kesey.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we go looking for him, and we're kind of high, and we can't find Ken, but we wind up making out, and she has a little baby who's a little baby girl who was, I can't remember his name right now, famous novelist. In fact, he wrote the whole thing about Kesey in the New Yorker not too long ago, last year or so. Stone. This is Robert Stone.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yes. Okay. Anyway, so Jane and I wind up in bed at the house, and Richard wakes up in the morning and finds us and says, "What do you mean sleeping with my woman?" And I laugh at him. I say, "Richard, you know, this is an open world. You know, I thought we all understood what happens in Millbrook." You know, he says, "All three of you get out of my house," et cetera, et cetera. And in the meantime, he's waking up Steve and Barbara. And Steve and Barbara are basically being supported by him, so they don't get involved, right?
Right.
So I got a problem. I was going to fly back to the church that day. So I've got to take Jane and her baby back to the church. Fortunately, within about 24 hours, Jane and Michael start getting it on, so Judy was cool. But you know,
You did take Jane back to the church.
Yeah, and she lived with us, and she was with Michael for quite a long time. And with the baby.
And this is Jane Burton. Who's
now all grown up and has her own daughter.
Right. But the Jane Burton, is she your age?
Maybe a little younger. She went to law school and became a fairly together civil, pacifist lawyer. And I think she's now retired.
And that she became a lawyer after she was with you?
Yes.
Yeah.
After the church, and after she returned to California.
Okay, so Albert, he's jealous of Steve. Is that the last time you see Alpert?
Is that the last time I see Richard? No, I attend the lecture after he's Ram Dass, and that was after, I think this was after the LSD conference. I'm not sure, though.
Yeah, and now you've told me about it's in the Bancroft oral history. You go to the LSD conference, and he is saying something that within a year or so he's going to contradict because he gets changed by the guy.
In India. And that was for the LSD conference, which is also in the opera, is sponsored by Richard Baker.
Right, the guy you really respect.
Before he was Roshi Baker.
But he was really a person of integrity. We've talked about him before.
Yeah, and he was the events coordinator for the University of California, as well as having been involved in the Zen Center, but not yet, not yet Suzuki Roshi's Dharma heir.
Did he take LSD, Richard Baker?
Yes.
So who were the speakers? Can you give us some details about this conference?
Oh, there were medical, academics. There was Paul Lee. There was Richard Alper. There was me. There was Ralph von Eckertsberg.
Walter Bowert, was he there?
Who?
Walter Bowert.
I don't know. Maybe Walter was in the audience. He wasn't one of the participants. There was
Tim Leary Associates.
Oh, yeah. Tim was one of the participants.
And this would probably be around 1965. This is before you're on the cover of Life, right? Does that help you think of it?
No, I don't really know. But I've got the details. In fact, I have two tapes right here of Richard's speech at the conference. I don't know if it has a date on it. Hold on.
But what did Richard say at the conference? There was something...
1966 LSD conference.
Does it have a month?
No.
Okay. But what is it that Alpert says there?
He says, Meher Baba told him through the guy who went to see Baba, his name I'll come up with in a minute, and who was inspired to go see Baba because he bought one of our psychedelic Baba posters at Brandeis.
And Meher Baba came into your world through Steve? Was it Steve who was inspired by Baba?
No. Meher Baba came into our world through some people in Woodstock who were part of the Meher Baba community.
Yeah, for those listening, Meher Baba was a famous, walking guru who never spoke, right?
Well, not never. At a certain point, he stopped speaking when he was quite young, and he wrote on a board.
A little school board.
Blackboard. And he could speak, but he didn't. And he was a guy who said, don't worry, be happy, which later on, became a big song.
Yeah.
And he was a fantastic being, and he's a guy who said, I am God, and you are God. The difference is I know I am.
And he had influence on Peter Townsend and the Who opera.
Other people. Yeah, anyway, Baba, through this messenger, sent back the message, stop using LSD.
To the conference?
Well, before the conference.
Okay.
And he started corresponding with Alpert, because Alpert was one of the leaders of the... pushing people into using it, and at one point he said, you can use it three more times, but after that. And at the conference, Richard said, and this is not a verbatim quote, but basically he said, no guru who hasn't used it himself is going to tell me what to do, And eventually, of course, through Bhagavan Das, he was in India, and he met his guru, and he gave the guru the LSD, supposedly, and it had absolutely no effect on him. And Richard was converted and took the name Baba Ram Dass and supposedly stopped using LSD, although I am aware of the fact that he didn't stop smoking grass.
Mm.
But, you know, then later on he had his terrible stroke.
Yeah.
And the beautiful film was made, and even though Richard and I were never really friends, although we knew each other well and didn't get along, I felt terrible empathy for him having gone through that.
Through the film you felt it?
Recovery. Through seeing the film, yeah.
Yeah.